Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today we'll discuss a new study by Dillon et al. Titled Nitric Oxide-Mediated Cutaneous Microvascular Function is Not Altered in Young Adults Following Mild to Moderate SARS-CoV-2 Infection. This article was published on January 28, 2022, as part of our call for papers on new developments in translational microcirculatory research. Joining me today are Associate Editor Amanda LeBlanc, authors Gabrielle Dillon and Lacey Alexander, and expert Melissa Whitman. Let's get started.
In this article by Dillon et al., healthy young adults who have had mild to moderate COVID-19 do not display alterations in nitric oxide-mediated cutaneous microvascular function. In addition, the authors also looked into whether healthy young adults who have had COVID-19 antibodies from prior vaccination displayed alterations in nitric oxide-mediated cutaneous microvascular function and found no changes. Lacey, maybe you can briefly walk us through how this study was first planned and what was the overall goal of the project.
Thanks, Amanda. Well, during the summer and spring of 2020, our group continued to have regular journal club meetings as we were, you know, all diving into potential questions as to how SARS-CoV-2 infection may impair endothelial dysfunction. During one of these journal clubs, we read the paper by Ratchford et al. Out of Appalachian State. And in this study, they performed both flow-mediated vasodilation as well as passive leg movement to look at vascular function in young adults who had recently recovered from COVID-19. These were otherwise healthy, young, college-age students who were infected with COVID early in the pandemic. And they were compared to a group of historical controls, so data that were collected prior to the pandemic. Their symptom severity was moderate to mild, and they were tested within 4 weeks after recovery from the virus. When we read the results of the paper, we were surprised and intrigued, partly because the values for FMD were very low in comparison to other studies in young, healthy subjects, as well as there was a significant difference in comparison to their historic controls. So we were interested in looking at the underlying mechanisms, as well as some potential changes in the microcirculation versus what happens in the conduit arteries. So as we began planning the study and slowly recruiting and returning to human subjects research, more questions arose with the rollout of the vaccines. And I think there are still many remaining questions in this study. We view this as really a foundational study for determining some of the time course and how different tissues, so skin versus muscle and macro versus microcirculation, may respond after the SARS-CoV-2 infection.
That's great. So looking at the results from two previous studies that showed blunted flow-mediated dilation and also one that showed femoral artery blood flow responses to single passive leg movement immediately following the mild to moderate COVID-19 in young adults, it seems like the current study was set up to see similar results since these responses are primarily NO-dependent. But this wasn't the case in the current study. Gabby, can you take us through some of the main reasons you could attribute these differences to from your study?
Definitely. First, I would like to congratulate both the Ratchford and Fidel lab groups for conducting such high quality studies so quickly, especially with all of the COVID-19 restrictions. There are several reasons that may contribute to the differences between the studies. The first and probably most significant is methodology. You are correct in that both previous studies examined macro and microvascular function via physiological stressors. And although the blood flow response to cuff inflation is predominantly nitric oxide mediated, there are other mediators such as adenosine, EDHFs, and ATP-sensitive potassium channels that also contribute to this response. By using intradermal microdialysis in the skin, in the present study, we were able to specifically pharmacodissect out the nitric oxide-mediated contribution to a local heating stimulus. Other reasons that could explain the differences between our studies include, but are definitely not limited to, the timing of when the participants were tested. Our COVID-19 recovered participants had a really large range and slightly greater average of days since having COVID-19. And another factor is symptomology. Again, within our participant cohort, there was a wide range in both the number and severity of symptoms in our participants who recovered from COVID-19. We had those who were completely asymptomatic, and we also had those who were pretty sick with intense flu-like symptoms while they had COVID.
Melissa, anything to add here?
Sure. As there are limited studies in this area to date, it is important to recognize that the timing post-COVID infection and the current symptomology when the participants were enrolled in these studies does vary greatly. So although the single passive leg movement results from Ratchford et al. Suggest microvascular dysfunction, these participants were in the acute phase, so only 3 to 4 weeks post-COVID-19 diagnosis and symptom onset. In the study out of the Fidel lab, they were studying young adults beyond the 4-week acute phase, and these participants were on average about 3 months post-COVID-19 diagnosis. Similar to Gabby's study, they also reported no microvascular dysfunction in the recovered group compared to the controls. However, they did observe evidence of both macro and microvascular dysfunction in the subset of adults who had persistent symptoms following COVID-19. Gabby's study included a much larger range in time post-diagnosis, and all of the post-COVID-19 participants were symptom-free at the time of testing. To further clarify this matter, Gabby really nicely ran a regression analysis that indicated no relation between time since diagnosis and ENOS-dependent vasodilation in the cutaneous microcirculation.
So the current study was able to assess the contribution of nitric oxide specifically to the blood flow responses. Lacey, is there any evidence to suggest that the contribution of adenosine, you know, EDHF, or potassium ATP channels could be changing in your system post-COVID?
We specifically utilized a 39-degree local heating protocol to isolate the effects of nitric oxide. And then, as Gabby mentioned, we pharmacologically blocked nitric oxide synthase production of NO with LNAbe. This particular protocol was developed out of Chris Minson's lab. And I think the beauty of it is that the vasodilation is almost exclusively NO-mediated. Unlike other protocols in the past that have used a 42-degree local skin heating protocol, where there's a greater percentage of vasodilation that's mediated through potassium channel mechanisms, I think that the study out of Paul Fidel's lab really did a nice job partitioning out differences between peripheral circulations and including what's happening in the brachial artery as well as what's happening in the cerebral circulations. They showed that those who were most symptomatic showed impairments, but they also showed no changes in cerebral blood flow. We have to keep in mind that the differences in signaling between vascular beds and how things like autoregulation and the particular stimulus that we use may to induce vascular changes in human subjects may differ. It may very well be that, similar to other clinical populations, the absolute magnitude of the vasodilation is preserved, but the mechanisms that mediate that vasodilation are different. So for example, when we look at other risk factors for cardiovascular disease, so for example, age or hypertension, we observe an inability to compensate for reductions in nitric oxide as some of these redundant mechanisms are decreased. This next question is for Melissa. In your opinion, as an expert reviewer, are there any other interesting results that stick out to you about this study?
So I think that both Lacey and Gabby have already touched on some of the big highlights of this paper. However, another interesting secondary objective of this paper was to explore if there were any differences in vascular function in young adults who had received a COVID-19 vaccine several months prior to their testing. So unfortunately, there is still a lot of vaccine hesitancy among the general public. And so evidence suggesting that having COVID-19 antibodies independent of the viral infection is not detrimental to the microvasculature is another important takeaway from this study, especially as we've seen just how important these vaccines are in preventing severe illness, hospitalization, and death.
Okay, so as we all know, science does not always go as planned, especially during a global pandemic. Were there any challenges or hiccups during the project that you can share with us, Gabby?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. It's definitely true that there's no such thing as an easy study, no matter how hard we try and plan ahead. but I think everyone can appreciate how difficult it is to work through all of the health and safety COVID-19 related regulations for human subjects research. We had to take a number of precautions, such as making sure everyone, including both lab members and participants, had adequate PPE, such as masks, face shields, gloves, et cetera, which at the time were very difficult to get a hold of with all of the shortages. We also had to make sure everyone was negative for COVID-19 before entering the lab, as well as altering our lab setup to ensure that during the studies, we could all be appropriately at least 6 feet apart as much as possible. But we also had a unique experience in that about halfway through the data collection, the COVID-19 vaccines became available. So we were forced to make some decisions on inclusion and exclusion criteria, and ultimately decided to try to make the study as translatable as possible by including all comers, such as those who were vaccinated with all different types of vaccines and those who were unvaccinated. We tried to do our best, but it was difficult to control for when and what types of vaccines people were receiving.
Yes, and just to add to that, there were recruiting challenges, many challenges related to the paperwork to get back to human subjects research. So our return to research plans. And I will say that Gabby has really done a heroic job here. She had to pivot her entire dissertation during the pandemic, and I think has found some really important research questions, as well as has demonstrated a lot of resilience in her graduate studies for completing this, and always with a smile on her face and seemingly always happy to come into work and into the lab.
You're too kind, Lacey.
Well, kudos to Gabby for being so resilient. One of the discussion points that was brought up during the peer review process was regarding the fact that some of the participants were partially vaccinated prior to their infection. And we know that vaccines limit the severity of the virus, but this also likely kept the post-COVID participants in the mild to moderate range, and that many of the post-COVID participants became fully vaccinated before they tested them. Melissa, what do you think about this?
I think this is a really interesting point that Gabby brought up in her discussion. There has been some anecdotal evidence that receiving vaccination, post-COVID-19 infection may improve symptoms, particularly in those experiencing long-haul COVID-19 symptoms. However, up to this point, that anecdotal evidence is really limited to self-report recall, and the very limited data that does exist is a bit conflicting, with some long haulers reporting an improvement in symptoms following vaccination, while others reported worsening symptoms, and many not reporting a change at all. Now, as far as I know, there have been no prospective trials conducted, and the mechanisms behind this potential phenomena are unknown. Regardless, in Gabby's study, removing the post-COVID-19 participants who were either partially or fully vaccinated prior to getting COVID-19 did not change the findings. However, I do think that there are likely many questions to still be answered as we move forward, considering the variety of symptomology, the presence of long hauler syndrome, as well as the timing of initial vaccinations, boosters, and the COVID-19 variants.
So as a researcher that's interested in the aging field, I've got to ask this next question. What can you speculate that the results might look like in an older population?
I think that this is a critical next step. In our prior work, we've found reductions in nitric oxide-dependent vasodilation with healthy human aging, as well as other alterations in endothelium-dependent mechanisms, including things like hydrogen sulfide with hypertension. So I would hypothesize that endothelium-dependent function or endothelial dysfunction would be greater in older subjects who have had COVID, as well as any other potential conditions, including underlying cardiovascular disease or other inflammatory diseases.
Overall, this study by Lacey's group has given us a really great foundation to work from by studying these young and otherwise healthy adults. So the aging question is an interesting one. As Lacey just mentioned, we unfortunately know that even healthy aging is accompanied by declines in nitric oxide bioavailability and vascular dysfunction. Further, we often have additional comorbidities and cardiovascular risk factors such as obesity, hypertension, et cetera, that accumulate with age. So moving this question into an older cohort is definitely one of the next steps that should be explored. And it will be fascinating to tease apart the age factor from the more severe symptoms, you know, for example, hospitalization and respiratory complications that are occurring in a lot of the older individuals.
This brings up a good point related to being able to identify microvascular dysfunction in a person as they age. So Lacey, do you think that the function of the skin microcirculation matches the function of microcirculatory beds elsewhere in the body? You know, are there instances where dysfunction in the microcirculation arises in the skin first, perhaps?
The data would suggest that impairments in skin microcirculatory function evolve at least in parallel with other vascular beds, including the coronary, renal, and skeletal muscle circulations. However, I think one of the advantages is that the skin is accessible. And over the years, we and others have developed specific protocols to isolate vascular signaling mechanisms. So for example, things like nitric oxide, EVHFs, potassium channel mechanisms, utilizing approaches like local heating of the skin, even local cooling, and infusion of investigational agents. I think that in some conditions, we do see deficits in the skin first. So for example, we've done studies in patients with psoriasis, whereas in other particular conditions, I think that the vascular dysfunction occurs in parallel as a systemic disorder. I do think that we have to keep in mind the disease state and whether the dysfunction starts in the micro versus macro vessels and the particulars of the disease.
So Gabby, what are some of the future directions this project is going in?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, the current study was conducted only in young, healthy individuals. Therefore, performing a similar study in an older cohort is definitely of interest. We are currently recruiting older, or should I say wiser, individuals to participate in a similar study. So if you're over the age of 65 and living in central Pennsylvania, feel free to give us a call. But we also have a lot of stored blood samples that we are excited to start analyzing with our close collaborators over at Johns Hopkins. We're going to hope to use those to look at the inflammatory profiles of our participants. And as I believe it was Melissa who mentioned earlier, we're also interested in looking at those with more severe COVID-19 symptomology as those with long-haul COVID symptoms. Also, as we know, the COVID-19 disease really impacted some certain demographics more than others. So I also think it would be interesting to investigate potential race and sex differences.
So with those stored blood samples you talked about, would you be able to distinguish which COVID variant that particular individual had when they were sampled? And can you then run a study to look at maybe what the effect of one variant is versus another?
Yeah, I do think that we could distinguish the COVID variant with our samples. And I think one of the other interesting potential collaborative projects with our group at Johns Hopkins, my longtime collaborator, Lakshmi Santhanam, is that we could do some different ex vivo assays. So treating different endothelial cells with the sera collected from our COVID patients with the different variants. And I think that that would be an interesting future direction to go into. We'll have to see. I think there'll be an exciting series of studies.
I hope I get to read about all those future experiments in some manuscripts in our journal. This has been a very insightful discussion. It's been a delight to get to chat with you all today. As we end this podcast, I just want to take a moment and thank our guests today, Gabby Dillon and her mentor, Lacey Alexander, out of the Knoll Laboratory at Penn State University, along with our topic expert, Melissa Whitman from the University of Delaware, for taking the time to discuss the study about how COVID infection and vaccination status affect NO-mediated cutaneous microvascular function in young healthy adults, published in AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology in 2022.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.